Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Chris Townsend, the creator of the Sphere L22 modeling microphone. But first, virtual reality and live music seem like they're made for each other. It's a match made in heaven. Well, why? Well, just think about it. One of the things that most people want to do is go to a show, but the vast majority of them can't make it for one reason or another. Now, this includes clubs, it includes larger venues, concert halls, even festivals. You'd like to go there, but you just can't travel that day, or you're working, or whatever the case. However, virtual reality now makes it possible that you can be at the show without actually being there. And venues all over the world are looking into this seriously as a new money-making opportunity. Because, just think about it, if you put the headset on and you're at the best seat of the house in front of the stage, you can look left and right and see the performers on the stage as if you were there. You look up, you can see the sound system and lighting and the ceiling. You look down, you see maybe a lighted dance floor. And if you look to your left and or to your right, you see all the audience members. You look at the back, maybe you see the bar. It's as if you're there. The only downside of all this is that the audio is still a little lacking. It's still lagging behind the picture part of virtual reality. And it's funny because there are plenty of VR audio tools out there. The integration is just not there yet, but pretty soon it will be. Now, what are the downsides here? Many venues are actually afraid that this might actually cost them some ticket sales because the VR experience might be too good. It might actually preclude people from leaving their homes to go to the venue and staying at home instead. So will this affect ticket sales in the long run? We don't know, but it's pretty interesting the fact that this may be one of the first places where virtual reality actually takes off in the music world. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my new Music Producer Formula course, as well as my other online video courses on bobbyosinskicourses.com. For more on my music industry and music production blogs, just go to bobbyosinski.com to find the links, where you can also read excerpts from my books. Now, there's an interesting story that just came out the last few weeks about a group of Israeli researchers from Ben-Gurion University that found out how they can reprogram PCs to turn headphones and earbuds into microphones. Yeah, just think about the security aspects of this, where all of a sudden you think that you're just listening to whatever it is that you're listening to on your cell phone, and in fact, somebody is listening into the conversation as well. It turns out that the Realtek audio codec that's used in most PCs, not Macs now, most PCs, is very vulnerable. No one ever even thought about the fact that this might be a security breach. So it's very easy to be reprogrammed to turn the output to an input, which of course then makes your earbuds or makes your headphones a microphone. Keep in mind, this is just a proof of concept. It's not that they actually did it. Well, they actually did it, but in fact, it's not out in the wild yet. But apparently, it's fairly easy to do, which makes you wonder, what might happen here? Will we have security measures that will be on all of our audio devices or our day-to-day computer devices? It looks like it's just around the corner because, of course, there's security concerns everywhere here. A bigger issue with all this is the fact that headphones, speakers, and microphones have not changed in their basic technology in more than 100 years. We're still moving air or capturing air the same way with a moving diaphragm. The way we do it may be different and it may be evolved, but the basic premise is still the same. So it would be really nice if we had some out-of-the-box thinking on how to actually improve that basic capture or replay technology, because that may solve the problem of security with our headphones, with our speakers, with our microphones, with our audio devices. My guest today is Chris Townsend, who spent 13 years at Avid Digidesign working on the company's 11 guitar amplifier modeler and the Revive room modeling technology. Chris headed out on his own with an idea to build a microphone that modeled the most desirable vintage mics that engineers just love, and the Sphere L22 was born. I spoke with Chris about the details of the mic via Skype from his home in the Bay Area. By the way, Chris's voice was recorded on a Sphere L22 on U47 mode. let's start at the beginning, though. Tell me how you get into this crazy business.
I don't know. Do you want the long version or the short version?
Long version's all right.
Okay. Let's see. I was in college and, well, even before college, I had a job programming databases for Bank of America, and I was miserable doing it. Not that, it was a perfectly fine, normal job. Absolutely nothing wrong with it. But for me, I just was not interested in it, and I saw myself doing this for the rest of my life, and it scared me. And I had been interested in sound and guitar and music and all that kind of stuff. So I started programming digital signal processing, a Motorola 56K board, if that means anything to you.
Yeah, it does.
And I made my own guitar effects processor. And
was this when you're still in high school?
At that point, it was college.
Okay.
I had sort of tried to do a few things in high school. Didn't get real far.
Were you in an engineering program in college?
Yeah. So then I majored in computer engineering. And so that gave me some software and hardware. So I had some basic programming and hardware engineering. And then I got a job as a DSP programmer, working for a very small plug-in company called Arboretum Systems. And that company basically went bust pretty quickly after I joined. And so then I got a job at DigiDesign. That's really where I got learned most of what I know, and was a fantastic experience, and was 13 years of my career was spent there.
Wow. What was the jump from there into building microphones?
Well, when I was at DigiDesign, I developed the 11 rack, or the 11 plugin, and the algorithms in that, the amp modeling technology and stuff. And we used various microphones for that, a U67, a U87. So I had spent a little bit of time experimenting with modeling guitar amps with those microphones. In that case, it's a very simple use case because the microphone is in a fixed position. You're just measuring sort of one sample. It's sort of like taking, sampling a piano and only sampling one key. So it's kind of a simple case of it. And, I started thinking, well, maybe this could be expanded. And I mean, a very, slow, not like I just overnight was just thinking that, but over time, started thinking about how microphones could be modeled in a more direct and accurate way.
Okay, so that's the basic impetus for the mic, I guess, but then what pushed you over the edge to say, okay, I'm going to go for it here? Because it's a big step when you haven't been, especially with the startup, when you haven't
Absolutely.
Been
Absolutely. Yeah, I had been involved in, the Arboretum Systems, the company I'd originally worked for was a startup, and I had been kind of involved in some others. And I knew jumping into my own business was a pretty big can of worms and a lot of unknowns and really not for the faint of heart, I guess you might say. But, well, part of it was at DigiDesign feeling like I had taken my career kind of as far as I could go there. I didn't really see new opportunities for me, and I like to work on new things. So when I looked at my prospects of, what I was most interested in working on, I felt like I needed to branch out. So that's what I did, and certainly, it was a big leap of faith.
Okay, so let's talk about the microphone. I'm sure it's developed a lot. The idea has developed a lot since the time you began with it. Tell me the initial idea behind it and how much has changed from right in the beginning.
Yeah, a long time ago, I kind of had thoughts of, well, maybe you could use a sound field microphone, a four-channel microphone. You could do, I mean, I had just kind of this general idea of, you know, sound field microphones are pretty cool.
Yeah.
But they've had very little in the way of adoption. And, you know, what's the reason for that? And so I started looking into some of that stuff, but concluded that, you know, four channels is, you know, too much for most applications, you know. And so I thought, well, yeah, two channels is probably a pretty good balance, gives you most of the benefits, at least in terms of modeling microphones.
When you were modeling your original batch of microphones, how did you go about doing it? And the reason why I ask is I've talked to other microphone, boutique microphone manufacturers, and a few of them in particular said, yeah, you know, on our C12, we modeled one and then we realized it wasn't a very good sounding one. So we had to get four or five of them and pick the best one. And I even talked to one boutique manufacturer, told me he had a dozen that he collected from all the rental companies around Los Angeles, and they put them up and they picked the best one. So did you do something like that? And then the other question is, it's a taste issue. What sounds the best? So how did you go about figuring that out?
Yeah, well, that's definitely a good question you bring up. I mean, when I started, just, you know, when I wanted to do proof of concept, I figured, well, maybe at the very beginning, I'll just start with some new microphones. Maybe I could just get a new 414 or a new 87. And just, I mean, this is like from sort of day one of like, what am I going to do? And I knew that that wasn't really going to get me all the way there, but it would just be, you know, step one. And so I kind of did that, made some progress with that. And then I found a studio. I knew this guy in San Francisco, and he let me use his studio, and he had a 47 and some Coles and a C37A and some older 414s and various things. So that was sort of one more step in the proof of concept and giving me sort of a range. But, you know, this was only one U47. So then, let's see, by now I've probably modeled five U47s.
Mm.
Maybe I'm at six. I've modeled four. No, I modeled five C12s. I've modeled three U67s. I've modeled, I don't know. So yeah, I just keep adding to it. And then in terms of how to make a judgment of, you know, what sounds best and which one to use. I mean, sometimes it's just, well, this is, you know, have to kind of take a guess. I mean, sort of very early on, but, you know, we put it in front of people. We ask their feedback. I kind of take my sort of first guess. There's, you know, one of the 47s we modeled seemed like it just was in bad condition. Like, to me, I just thought pretty clearly this is not a good example of a 47. It had some kind of wonky stuff in the high frequency in around 10 kilohertz. And two of the 47s that I modeled actually matched surprisingly well. And this other one really seemed like an outlier. Actually, really, the four that I modeled were kind of all in the same ballpark. So then the one that was outlier, well, just I'll just ignore that, or maybe it'd be fun to add as a, you know, weird one. But yeah, just kind of go from there, get feedback on it.
Yeah.
But sometimes they're pretty close and doesn't matter a whole lot. Sometimes they're really different. So it just depends.
Okay. So then when someone selects a model, are they only getting one model, or are they getting a sample, or they're able to select between the four you've modeled, for instance? How does that work?
Right now, we only have one of each microphone, but certainly we're thinking about having multiple versions in the future. I'm pretty sure we'll do that. I think it helps highlight to the customer that, you know, not every 47 and not every C12 is the same, and you know, gives them some options. And if it happens to be a customer who has a 47 or a C12 by chance, it maybe helps them see that, well, maybe it doesn't perfectly match their 47, but you wouldn't expect it to, given the variation that there is. So, yeah, I think over time we'll just provide more options.
How did you come up with the name? Sphere 1122.
L22.
It's L22, yeah.
I came up with a big list, and my business partner, Eric, also added a lot to the list, and we just had a lot of names, and most of them were terrible, and we just started whittling it down, and Sphere was just one I had come... I was just thinking 3D and just kind of riffing off of three-dimensional, and, you know, what would be a name that was three-dimensional, but just sounded cool. And yeah, so Sphere was, it was just one that I had added to the list, and then we just slowly kind of whittled it down. And
yeah, but the L22 is what I'm interested in. Does that mean it's a 22nd version?
No, it means it's a two capsule, two output microphone.
Oh.
And it's a large diaphragm.
Oh, of course.
So, you know, there's a method to the madness.
Yeah.
And you can imagine that by calling it that, we have some inclination that maybe we'll have future microphones, you know, a product line of some sort.
Yeah.
Obviously, probably a long way till we actually get that happening.
Why is it two-channel? I mean, I think it's brilliant that it's two-channel rather than saying it's stereo, because you can have different models. Obviously, it must be more difficult to make two channels and more expensive, or not. I don't know. Tell me. I'm curious as how you came up with two channels.
I mean, it uses two channels because that gives you a fair amount of directional and distance information about the sound field that you're recording in. If it's a single channel microphone, you have absolutely zero directional and distance information. You know nothing about distance, so you cannot model proximity effect except maybe at a single distance. And you cannot model polar patterns.
I see.
There's basically no way to model polar patterns with a single channel microphone.
Got it.
So going to two channels, you may have seen these older microphones. There's the Sennheiser MKH Twin, I think is one. It's a dual channel mic. And of course, there's the four channel sound field microphones. And with those, you can change the polar pattern after you record the audio. You know, that seemed pretty neat to me. So yeah, with two channels, you can synthesize different polar patterns, and you can have different polar patterns at different frequencies, which is kind of what actually happens in a real microphone.
Okay, I get it. That makes perfect sense.
To be a little more technical, basically the L22 microphone has a cardioid capsule on the front and a cardioid capsule on the rear, just like a traditional large diaphragm condenser microphone, such as a 87. And if you sum the two capsules together, you end up with Omni. If you subtract the rear capsule from the front, you end up with Figure 8. And by blending in different combinations, then you can synthesize kind of the whole range of polar patterns.
Got it. Okay, makes sense. Is the DSP on board, or is it in the software, or combination?
So, yeah. So the DSP is entirely in software. That may be a, you know, VST or AAX native plugin. It can also be running on a DSP in the UAD platform. But the microphone itself doesn't have any DSP processing. And we did that you know, largely because it allows people to change all of these settings of the microphone after the fact, which you know, we think is a big advantage. And you know, so that was a lot of the impetus for that.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
And, you know, when it's paired with, say, an Apollo or something, then it becomes a pretty nice self-contained system in my mind. And, you know, there isn't really any latency concerns. And so you kind of have all that taken care of. The other thing is putting a user interface on a microphone to control the different models and settings, and then to update the software in the microphone, the algorithms, and add new algorithms as you go, seems like a really tricky process. You know, maybe you would use your phone or your cell phone to control the models on the microphone. But just the more we thought about it, just the more cumbersome all of that seemed. So figured it'd be better to bypass all of that.
Could you use the microphone without the DSP?
Absolutely. Yeah. If you just plug in the front channel connector of the microphone, then it's just a traditional cardioid microphone.
Cool. There are other manufacturers that are making similar products. Well, I shouldn't say similar. They're making model microphones. What is the difference between the L22 and the competition?
Primarily, it's that it's a dual-channel microphone and that it can model proximity effect and polar patterns. And so that means when we model a 47, for example, we're modeling the 47 at different distances. We're modeling it when you set it to the Omni pattern. We're modeling it when you set it to the cardioid pattern. And we're modeling the frequency-dependent polar pattern. So in the case of a 47, it's not necessarily exactly cardioid. It's kind of more supercardioid. It's a little more directional than cardioid, and it kind of depends on frequency. It goes a little bit more omni at low frequencies. And so we're able to model those kind of characteristics.
I noticed there's a cowl switch on it. What's that for?
That just takes the front capsule and outputs it on both channels. And so it's just an easy way to make sure you have the same levels on your preamp channels. So that's the main thing you want to keep in mind when you use the L22. You want to set your preamp channels to have the same gain. And so with an Apollo or a modern recording interface that has digitally controlled preamps, generally you just hit the link button on the preamps and they stay linked and they're perfectly matched, and it's super easy. If you're using, say, an API or something like that, then maybe you would use the cowl switch. But, you know, mm-hmm. for many people, they wouldn't need to use the cowl switch.
Okay. That makes sense. So how many models do you have? You have a 47 and a 67, a C12. I saw even there was a 57 model in there, which was an unusual choice, I should say. But How many models do you have?
It's 8 models plus a sphere linear model and a sphere linear diffuse model. And the sphere linear model is basically designed for a flat on-axis response. And the sphere diffuse model is for flat kind of from all directions. So if you're using it as a room mic or something, it will pick up the reverberation with a relatively flat response.
That's cool. There's a lot of people that are doubters out there of modeling microphones. And I know that you had some golden ears that have gone through this, and I know Joe Ciccarelli is one, and I'd always respect whatever his response suggestion might be. But what would you tell people, what would be the main reason why they'd want to consider a modeling microphone, an L22, as opposed to just saying, well, I'll take that same money and I'll buy a boutique version of a microphone? And I know the versatility is a big thing, but is there something else besides that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different reasons. Of course, it depends on the customer and their particular needs and budget and all sorts of factors. Even if you have a fantastic microphone collection, you might want to buy Sphere. And, you know, being able to change your microphone type and polar pattern after the fact can be pretty cool. I think on a guitar amp, that can be pretty nice to dial in the sound. Usually people use multiple microphones on a guitar amp and then blend them together. With Sphere, you can blend multiple models together from a single microphone. So you've quite a bit of options there. You might be concerned about your microphones being damaged on a loud guitar amp or a kick drum or a vocalist with a lot of plosives, particularly if it's a ribbon microphone. You might want something that you can travel with, that you're not, you know, you could take with you on the road and you're not scared about it, losing it or getting stolen. I mean, it's, you know, Sphere isn't a cheap microphone, but it's replaceable, whereas some of these older microphones are getting to where they're irreplaceable. And these older microphones can also be a lot of work to maintain and can have some pretty significant problems. I'd say, quite a few of the microphones we modeled, as far as I could tell, were not functioning properly.
Yeah.
Really, they needed new diaphragms, and maybe had other problems. New diaphragms, I'd say, was the most common issue.
Let's go there for a second. The tolerances between Sphere microphones, what's that like? Or does it matter? Can you actually calibrate them via software so they're all the same?
Yeah, we go to quite a bit of effort in the manufacturing of the microphone to make sure that the tolerances of the L22 from microphone to microphone are accurate. So that, you know, you can use any microphone and you'll get, you know, very close to the same results. That means the capsule's quite a bit more expensive because you need quite a bit more quality control. Potentially we could offer individual calibration in software. That would be at least theoretically possible. So a user could download a calibration file and then make their microphone exactly the same as the calibration reference microphone, basically. And that I think is a pretty good, you know, when you think about this, if we can go out and find, you know, some really good microphones to model, which I think we have, you know, that can be a better situation than a lot of people. If they just want to go out and buy a 47, it's pretty questionable if they're going to get a good one. I mean, it very much could be a lemon, and you need to know what you're doing if you're going to buy one of these old microphones. It's not just, oh, I'll buy it on eBay and it'll be great. It could be terrible. Could be fantastic. It's hard to say, but with Sphere, you know, we can go out and select kind of the best of the best, or have and as we were talking about before, we can have multiple models of the same type of microphone and offer those, and those can all be kind of, you know, within the best of the best.
How long did it take for you to set up the manufacturing part of this? And I know that Eric, your partner, already has some experience in doing this, but I don't think in microphones, though, and that's kind of a different part of the world, you know, the audio
it
world.
It is. I mean, Eric did, distributed a microphone line in his previous career, but... yeah, he had not done any manufacturing for that. And, you know, we're building this microphone in China. And Eric had only had experience building, production in the U.S. And so, you know, that was also very new. But, you know, we felt getting it built in China, where most microphones are built these days, really was the best option.
Are you delivering yet?
No. It's as of today, it's nearing the end of production, probably another couple weeks, hopefully, if all goes well, and then they'll get shipped to the U.S. We'll do... another round of quality control. We'll measure every microphone, listen to every microphone, make sure that they're all in good shape, and then hopefully ship them out.
Cool. Okay, so you did a crowdfunding campaign, which was pretty cool, and you met your goal. You did better than your goal. So what made you want to do that, a crowdfunding campaign? Was that something strategic? Was it? Well, let me back up for a second. A lot of companies have plenty of money in order to do what they need in manufacturing, and they do the crowdfunding campaign almost as a PR move in order to build visibility for a new product. Was that the idea behind that, or was it actually getting money for manufacturing?
Well, I would say it was both of those, and also some other things. I mean, up to that point, the company was basically self-funded by me. I didn't really want to continue doing that. We also really, you know, we didn't know 100% how the market would respond to this product. And so... And respond to the price point, respond to kind of everything about it. And so really we wanted to make a determination of that. I mean, we felt like we had a great product, but you never know until it's, you know, people can actually put down their money. And... So, you know, I think clearly it proved that there's a market for it, and that's a very big benefit.
Yeah.
The other benefit is raising the money before we go into production, because if we did a production run, we without that, we'd have a pretty hard time judging how many we should make. With crowdfunding, we have a much better ability to judge that. I mean, we have sort of the direct orders we get from that, but then we also have the general, you know, we ended up getting a lot of distributors and retailers contacting us saying, we want to distribute your product. So it was a huge benefit also in that respect. And so then we were able to further judge what the demand was. And then, as you mentioned, just general marketing of the product, I think, can be a big value of a crowdfunding campaign. The crowdfunding doesn't really do any marketing by itself. You still have to do your own marketing so that people know about the campaign. But, you know, it can give your product kind of a buzz if you do it right and you kind of can reach out to the right sort of people. And so I would say all of those things were kind of the reasons behind it.
Well, Russ Hughes was telling me that you had some significant growing pains that really were beneficial. So you took it some early versions into some engineers who were very blunt about what they thought. But he said that it turned out to be something that was great. How did you feel after that happened?
Good. Well, you know, you have to put all of that stuff in perspective. So I had a lot of feedback on this product and on the prototypes as I was going. So I probably built a couple dozen what I would call Frankenstein prototypes. So those are where I just took some existing microphone, fairly cheap one, and just ripped out the guts and modified it and had something that was enough to do a proof of concept with. Not really the same microphone at all that we're shipping, but just something with two channels and a large diaphragm capsule and sort of the basic parameters of it. And then I could calibrate my algorithms for these prototype microphones. And so I sent them around to various recording engineers and hobbyists and just different range of people, some kind of A-list and, you know, most not, but all sorts of different types, and got all sorts of different feedback. And some of it was very positive, some of it was very negative. And so I had to kind of put that all into perspective, kind of see what the general trends were in terms of feedback, and kind of synthesize what I thought was the best, you know, direction. So
yeah,
I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Well, yeah, I know anytime you get criticism and you get feedback, you have to weigh it with a grain of salt, because sometimes it can be very valuable and sometimes not so much. So yeah, I know that's a tightrope that everybody walks.
Yeah. So I, you know, listened to every piece of feedback and considered it in some sense, at least. And part of the thing that Russ is referring to is a product demo that we did, a couple years back from some, a lot of A-list people actually, and magazine reviewers and, you know, Paul White and some, you know, some heavy hitters. And, you know, those people, generally it was positive feedback. Some of them were like, well, this wouldn't really fit into my workflow. I want to use analog outboard gear. I want to, I think we concluded that, you know, this product isn't for everybody. We think it's for a lot of people, but you know.
Yeah, I get it. If you're going to use some analog preamps, let's just say you have a couple of API preamps and you want to go through it. So you're obviously not going to be using the software, but could you record the two channels analog into your DAW and then later use the software in order to manipulate the sound?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so there's no downside then to just recording analog through analog.
Well, yeah, I mean, as opposed to a USB or Thunderbolt interface that has mic preamps built into it. I mean, the API, you do need to adjust the gains on each channel to be equal, and we've made that as easy as possible. So yeah. That would be the only
downside. I was getting the wrong impression for a while that there was a big advantage, and I guess there is an advantage, but it maybe it seemed larger than it is. If you recorded through an Apollo, for instance, where you had direct control over it as you were recording, and I can see the value of that, but I can also see it's not necessary, which is a cool thing.
Yeah, it really isn't. I mean, we weren't quite sure how much of an issue that kind of thing would be for people. When we've done it or watched other people use their, you know, older analog preamps with analog gain control, you know, so far we've found that it hasn't really been a big deal, and I would say it's not as big of a deal as we thought it might be. But, you know, on the other hand, we feel like the overall best experience with our product typically is with an Apollo, but also you can have a great experience through lots of other products for sure.
Got it. Okay, last question. Thank you for spending time with me today, Chris. This is great. I really enjoyed the conversation and learning, you know, more about the microphone, because I've been intrigued ever since I first saw it. When you were going through this experience, this startup experience, the second startup experience, was there a piece of business advice that someone imparted to you, or something that you learned along the way that was kind of like an aha experience, or just something that you learned that you think was important?
Yes. I mean, probably a number of things, but let me see if I can think of one in particular that really stands out. One thing I did is I read this book called Four Steps to Epiphany by Steve Blank, who is a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, I guess I would say. He was involved in about 10 startups in his career. And he said 8 of them were spectacular failures. One was a moderate success, and one was a out-of-the-park home run. So that kind of gives you an idea of what the risk profile is on a Silicon Valley startup. And anyways, he came to the conclusion that the biggest reason why startups fail, and maybe I'm oversimplifying things, but is that companies don't make the right product for the right customer. I mean, that is that they're making a product and there isn't really a customer or enough customers for that product. And it, you know, may on the face of it seem like a good idea. They may be even able to find people who say, oh, that's a good idea in the abstract. But when it comes to actually finding real people who are actually going to put their money down, I would say often for startups, it's because they haven't figured out exactly what the right product, you know, they haven't really drilled down into what the customer wants and gotten out of, gotten outside of their office and outside of their head and in front of the customer and to actually see it in action. That said, you also can't just directly accept what a customer or various customers tell you as this is what it should be. Or, I mean, customers don't necessarily know what they want exactly anyways. I'd say, especially when it's something new and innovative, very rarely do they. They kind of have to see it before they can appreciate it. I think that definitely is something we saw, that I would explain the idea to people and often get kind of a lukewarm response. But when I showed it to people, often the response was much better. And, you know, I guess that probably shouldn't be that surprising. But it's definitely something that stood out.
To find out more about the Sphere L22 modeling mic, just go to townsendlabs.com. That's TOWNSEND Labs, all one word, townsendlabs.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, or Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.